Welcome back to Borderlines, Lagos, Nigeria, India, abroad. Some of you, wherever you're listening from, this is Nigeria Info FM Lagos. This is Borderlines. We are still streaming live on nigeriainfo.fm. Right, my guest, Najim Animashari, is a development specialist and a policy analyst and something of an expert, as you've heard. See how he took us all the way back to the Arab Spring. You people forgot. You keep thinking, 710. You see, everything has bricks. Foot, brick, the set, and then the form, a wall, or something happens. Right, Najim, talk to us about the Abraham Accord. The Abraham Accord, which was one of the triggers for Hamas. Why was it a trigger for Hamas? And is it working? Is the accord working? And can it work without an independent Palestine?
To be honest, you can have any number of accords without an independent Palestine. So, yes, it can. We already have the Camp David peace accords between the Egyptians and the Israelis, where the Israelis gave back the Sinai and signed a peace treaty with Egypt, and Egypt recognized Israel. And both of them basically have created a hard border with Gaza. They've fenced Gaza, or you can call it a wall, you can call it a fence, you can call it both. But the Philadelphia crossing, which is in the south of Rafah, is on the Egyptian side. The Egyptians are not letting any Palestinians into Egypt, into the Sinai Desert. And Egypt has done that from the very beginning, from 1947, when the State of Israel was created, and they started to displace Palestinians from what was historical Palestine to make way for the new state of Israel, the only Arab country to close its borders, to not allow Palestinians in, was Egypt. And that is the Rafah border, right? They have never allowed the Palestinians into Egypt. So the Israelis had no choice but to create this little enclave in Gaza and pen the Palestinians that they had expelled from other parts of Israel, right, in that space. And so a lot of people who are in Gaza actually are descendants of people who come from the other side of the fence, north of the Eretz crossing, and most of the places that are now the kibbutzim. Right?
Yeah.
So I know I'm going in a roundabout way to answer the Abraham Accords, but I was trying to explain to you that you don't need a Palestinian state to have a peace accord with Israel,
okay,
as the Camp accord demonstrated.
Mm-hmm.
What was particularly irksome to Hamas about the Abraham Accords was that it was essentially a multi-nation Arab offering of peace to Israel without Palestine being a precondition to making that peace.
Ah, so no, say that again very slowly, because I keep getting questions. And we've addressed this. You've said it. You've presented it in a totally different way. Just say that again very slowly, please.
Yes, the Abraham Accords was designed as a peace agreement between Israel and Gulf Arab states, right, without a requirement for there to be progress on the Palestinian issue. So the Palestinian issue wasn't a condition for making peace. This is a derogation from traditional Arab postures and positions, the Arab League postures and positions from the outset. Now, there was a certain amount of arrogance on the part of the Israelis, particularly Netanyahu, in pushing the accords and basically treating the Palestinian issue as something that could be managed rather than resolved. That was Netanyahu's mistake, particularly if he's allowing Qatar to continue funding them, to continue to divide the Palestinians between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas, and saying there's no partner for peace, right? So that was a strategic mistake by Netanyahu, right? The strategic mistake by the Gulf states was to think that the Palestinian issue was another issue, Don't forget, the Palestinians are kind of orphans in the Arab world. None of the Arab states around Israel, right, essentially wanted the Palestinians. And none of them have actually given Palestinians citizenship. And in this way, Israel is actually probably better, has treated the Palestinians, the Arab Israelis who were who remained in Israel after the 1947-1948 expulsions, right, has probably treated those Palestinians better than the generational Palestinians in the refugee camps in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and Egypt, who have not been given citizenship. So to some extent, the Israelis do have a point in that you have Israeli citizens who are Arabs, but you don't have Jordanians who are Palestinians who are Jordanians who are Jordanian. Fortunately for them in Jordan, the queen, Queen Rania, is a Palestinian, right? And she identifies with Palestinians. But you will have many generations of people, particularly in Nigeria, we have people who we call Lebanese. They're not Lebanese at all. They're Palestinians, right? And they will tell you they're Palestinians. They are not Lebanese, but we call them Lebanese. And if you ask them, produce your passport, they can't. Many Palestinians had to leave Lebanon or Egypt to go to Europe to get a passport in order to be able to come back, right? So it's not as if the neighboring Arab countries have treated the Palestinians much better in terms of giving them a status of statehood.
Okay.
So when it comes to the Abraham Accords, I'm coming back to the Abraham Accords here. When it comes to the Abraham Accords, you can't blame the Saudis for looking at the Palestinian issue as something that is a bit of a problem that they just have to carry. And it affects them making deals that are beneficial to their economy, right, because of an issue that has not been resolved for 75 years.
Right.
So, in a roundabout way. Now, Hamas, during the Abraham Accords, could have asked the Saudis and the Emiratis and the Moroccans, and particularly the Moroccans, to basically tell the Israelis, we're making this contingent upon you acknowledging the demands of Hamas. Right, if Hamas wanted to do that. Now, Hamas has said in the past that they were open to hudas, that is, long-term truces, agreements with the Israelis, with the Israeli government. They've often been dismissed. And even in 2006, 2007, they made a very strong offer to basically move their position from the destruction of Israel to a more accommodating position. I believe Khaled Meshal wrote an article in The Guardian to that effect, and they were basically poo-pooed by Egypt, the US, the UK, and Israel, who tried to overthrow them, right? And I'm not just saying this. Tony Blair, who was prime minister of the UK at the time, then later said in 2015 or 2016 in his memoirs that they really missed an opportunity to move Hamas towards the pathway to peace when Hamas was offering that after they won an election. So, yeah, you can say that the Abraham Accords, but the Abraham Accords are part of a continuum where there's a lot of fatigue, Palestine fatigue amongst Arab nations, right? There are missed opportunities on both sides, which I've tried to show from the Palestinians and from the Israelis and from the Saudis. There have also been mistreatment of the Palestinians, not just by the Israelis, although the Israelis have been the most egregious, right? And also they are the most culpable because they drove the Palestinians from their land. But there have been, you know, mistreatment of the Palestinians in terms of offering them statehood and a chance to rebuild their lives in other countries, in a way that Israel has allowed, even though they still oppress them, have allowed Arab Jews, Arab Israelis to take on citizenship. Okay. So as I said, there's a lot of moving parts in this thing. You can't just come with one size fits all. To sum it up, the Abraham Accords can be made without the Palestinians, but what Hamas has basically said to the world, to everybody, you cannot shave my head in my absence, right? And everybody realizes, yes, we cannot shave Hamas's head in their absence. That is it.
Exactly. Thank you. That was broad. That was enlightening. Look, you're going to be able to ask Najim questions. So hang on, I know some of you are already calling. One question I have before I go on to my second one. Quickly, why do the Arabs not like the Palestinians? Or am I wrong? Is it that they don't like them? Or is it that they find them to be, you know, a problem that they have to deal with? When they look at the Palestinians, they see their failure. Is it something like that?
I think you could be onto something there. I'd not thought about it that way. I think to some extent, I'll give you an example. I'm a Muslim, as you well know. Mm-hmm. And I sent a hadith of the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, to a very close friend of mine in Saudi Arabia, who's been sending me all sorts of stuff about how terrible the Israelis are. And I sent the hadith basically says, there will come a day when you Muslims, when the enemies of you Muslims will be meeting to feast on your parts. In other words, they'll be dividing you and taking you apart. And one of the companions of the Prophet said, oh, will that be a time when we will be few and we'll be weak? And the Prophet responded, no, you'll be many, but your impact will be like the foam on the ocean. In other words, you'll be making a lot of noise, but not a lot of impact. Mm. Now, when I look at this, I say to myself, there are 200 or 300 million Arabs, right? Mm-hmm. 200 million Arabs, probably more than that, 250 million Arabs. If you include Sudan, you're going into 300 million stage, right? And a nation of 12 million, and if you take away the Palestinians, probably 7 million, right, is able to hold all of them at bay and put all of them in mortal fear. Right. And the hadith ends that you'll be many, but your love of this world and your fear of death will make it easy for your enemies to conquer you.
Interesting that you bring in that hadith, because that's a good segue into my next question, actually. Anti-Semitism. We've heard, I've just played Prime Minister Netanyahu accusing the protesting students of anti-Semitism. Yet, we had Jews, we had Muslims, you had Christians, you had, you know, secular students, everybody, students, professors, everybody's there, black, white, orange, pink, whatever. They were there. How ridiculous is it to accuse a Palestinian, an Arab, of anti-Semitism? How ridiculous is that? Take us back to that connection.
I have a very close friend who's Jewish, and I was in America on 9/11. Mm-hmm. And the first group of people that reached out to the Muslim community was the Jewish community. And I remember I was on a show like yours in Maine on Saturday. I think it was the 15th, the morning of Saturday. It was myself and a rabbi and a preacher, and we were talking about the events that happened, and we were trying to comfort people who were calling. And about halfway through the show, I just broke down and started to cry. I had not slept for 5 days. I had a baby and I didn't know what was happening. I had brothers in New York. You know, it was all chaos at the time. Two of the two lead hijackers at 9/11 flew off from the airport in the city where I lived, and the airport was 2 kilometers from where I was staying, right? They had spent their last night eating at an eatery that I eat at, and they went to the Walmart where I went to buy diapers for my daughter that very night.
Wow.
Right? The first community that came to the aid of the Muslims were the Jewish community, right? And, you know, the rabbi put his arm around me. And the rabbi, you have to understand that the rabbi himself, his family members, many of his family members had been killed in the Holocaust. The other person, who's a very close friend of mine, he was actually born in a concentration camp, you know? So, when you meet these people and you talk to them, you get a real sense of the trauma, the generational trauma that they carry, but also the empathy that they have, which is why, going to what you're saying about the campus, you will see Jewish students who are on that campus, right, are advocating for this. You will see those who are, they're very Jewish, and they bring out those elements of Judaism and that. In terms of the Arabs, and this is where the scholarship of Professor Avi Shlaim of Oxford University is very telling, in that the Arab Jews never had that experience of Holocaust in Muslim lands. Because Arab Jews are Arabs, and Arabs are Semites.
Exactly.
Because they're children of Shem, right? You know something that happened in Israel recently, when the Iranians fired all those rockets, and the Israelis said there was only one little girl that was injured, and she was a Bedouin.
That's right.
Right? Those people have been roaming that area since the time of our father Abraham. Right?
Right.
And you'll know a lot of Bedouins. They go by the name Badawi. So the BBC news presenter,
Zena Badawi, yes,
she's a Badawi, right? A Badawi is a Bedouin. And even in the time of the Prophet Muhammad, they used to call them a Badawi, a desert Arab, right? Now, when you think of how Moses and the children of Israel coming out of Egypt into Sinai, who are they going to meet? These people.
Right. So this is a thing.
So you can't say that, oh, this whole land from the river to the sea is just for Jews. The Jews met people there, even at the time when they left Egypt.
Indeed.
Moses' wife was likely to, his wife, when he was in the wilderness, was likely to have been one of these. Ishmael's wife, in the Bible, says he married an Ishmaelite woman. Esau's wife, he married an Ishmaelite woman. Where does Uncle Laban come from for Isaac to get his wives? My point is that entire group of that entire area, it was filled with nomads and transhumans people. And there were cities scattered around, like Jericho, which Joshua took the walls of, right? And that was their first conquest. Then they built Jerusalem, right? So the point I'm trying to make about Semites is that in the larger context of the word Semitic, yes, Arabs and Jews are the same people. Their languages are similar. Shalom, salam. Right? Benjamin Netanyahu, bin is son of. Yamin is the son of the righteous. My point is that their names are similar. Their language is similar. Their customs are similar. Their religion is the same.
Indeed.
Right? So, like all families, they have terrible fights. But unlike the West, the Christian West, Arabs do not see Jews as Christ killers, which is part of the driving narrative for much of the pogroms and the Holocaust that Jews have suffered in Europe. They haven't suffered them in the same way in Arab or Muslim lands. In fact, when the Catholic kings of Spain reconquered Spain, in Arabic history, Spain is considered Andalus, Al-Andalus. And there's still a province in Spain called Andalusia, right? It isn't any different from Morocco. That part of Spain is really not very different from Morocco. Now, when you look at Gibraltar, that little rock at the end of Spain that the Spanish want back, but it's British, right? If you go to Tangier, you can actually see Gibraltar from Tangier. It's 15 kilometers away, right?
Yes, you can.
Tapa Bay is further from Lagos, right? Which is in Nigeria, than Morocco, which is in Africa, is from Spain.
Absolutely. But I'm going to interrupt you there. I've actually been to that. I've been to that border, and it says stone's throw away. Where we are right now, and look, you can call because I know some of you have questions because we've gone into that area that you all like, the ancient, the Christianity, they're the people of the people and all of that stuff. 0700-993-993-993. The female only line is 0201-465-7190. Last week, I said, was Passover. We had, see, the calls are already coming in. Bear with me a second. Now, Jim, I will take the calls and then I will come back to you. Hello? Hello?
Yeah, Chief Minister Itibakar.
Good Chief evening. Minister, good evening. How are you? I cannot hear you anymore. How are you? Oh, dear. Hello? Oops, hello?
Hello?
Yes, good evening. Okay. Hello.
Hello, good evening.
Good evening. What's your name and where you calling from, please?
You have Titi Lokpe on the line, calling you from Maui.
Okay, Titi Lokpe, what is your question?
Thank you. Number one, before Abraham Accord was, Oslo Accord, 94, where Clinton was the president. And just like our guest said, Shalom Salam was Serbia, peace. So a year after, American Congress passed the law. That Congress was demanded by the Republicans, and they moved the resolve to move the capital of Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And no American president, whether it was Bill Clinton, Obama, Bush Jr., was able to do that until Donald Trump came in 2017. He did that, and after that, he brought up the Abraham Accord. Do you think it's going to work? It's not going to work. And that is why I asked you the other day, when you had a guest from Palestine the other day, that if Donald Trump becomes the president in November, all these two-state solution is already dead. And the world is standing up against Israel now, trying to bring back the two-state solution, even though we have some hypocritical tendencies in America. But that is being pushed back now.
Okay.
So the question finally is this. Are we going to have Oslo Accord standing, not dead totally, and at the same time, Abraham Accord? Which one is going to happen? Now, Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, officially. Can we move that? Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's a rich one. Hold on to that. Let me go to the next call, and then I'll give you 5 minutes to address both. Hello?
Yeah, Chief Mrs., can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now, Chief Minister. Go ahead.
Yeah, Alhaji Adimashan, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, he owns my area, Nainsuleri.
No, it's not the same person. There are
good. Quick one.
Same family.
Yeah, same family, but not the same person. Go ahead.
Okay. You know, Yoruba say o ma se o. We have this type of person as a Nigerian, right? Hello, Chief Minister.
Yes, I'm listening to you, sir.
Oh, my God. This is brain. But how did you get here?
Well, okay, we need to talk about the subject. Let's not go
I
on.
I know, but I just want to, appreciate him.
Okay.
I'm so happy that he's a Nigerian.
Okay.
I want to say thank you very much, my brother. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chief Minister. Thank you. Okay, I'm coming to the next. Can you please ask your question? This is not an appreciation society for you Surulere people that have discovered your Animashan people. Right. Hello?
Yeah, so good evening, CC Ogi.
Good evening. What's your name? Where are you calling from, please?
You have Emmanuel. I'm calling you from Ekpe.
Go ahead, Emmanuel from Ekpe.
Yeah, my question is, I'm looking at the future.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was once the Babylonian Empire, the Egyptian Kingdom, you know, the Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm looking at, what if if we flip the coin, like in the future we have a different, you know, a world power, like it seems to be happening, you know, Russia, Iran, China, and then these people are not people who are in alignment with Israel, you know, and then this seems to, because we've had powers, you know, come and go. How will it look like if your guests can speak to that?
So what is the question? How will it look like if Russia and China were to be the new world power? Okay.
In the reaction of Israel and the present war power, are they taking that into consideration? Those are my questions.
All right, superb. Did you hear that, Najim?
Yes, I did.
Okay,
yes,
right. You have two questions there. The lines are going crazy. I'm going to give you 5 minutes. I have to restrict you because we've got loads of calls and we're still only halfway through.
Let me answer the questions in order,
mm-hmm.
Because they relate to each other.
Okay.
The first question was about the Abraham Accords and the viability of a two-state solution after after Oslo,
mm-hmm.
and whether or not in the aftermath of Trump nominating the Jerusalem as the as the capital, eternal capital of the state of Israel, whether there's any going back on that. The answer is yes. The question is, what is a two-state solution? The problem with Oslo wasn't the intent. The problem with Oslo was implementation and the leadership that was required to make the painful concessions that were made when the Egyptians and the Israelis signed a peace agreement and they returned Sinai to Israel, to Egypt. Israel has a fundamental problem. And its fundamental problem is that it is a victim of its own conquests, right? It has a terrible dilemma that in order to remain a democracy, right, it may end up ceasing to be Jewish, right? Because Palestinians are now 20% of the population and it keeps another 6 million Palestinians under lock and key in the West Bank and Gaza, right? If it remains a Jewish a country, an exclusively Jewish country, it probably has to cease to be a democracy, which is currently what it is doing.
Right.
Suppressing the Palestinians, right? So there are two options. It can have an amicable divorce whereby it gives the Palestinians their own state. But does that divorce, giving the Palestinians their own state, mean that Israel will have security? Because the Palestinians are not going to like the Israelis, period. Right? The second problem that it will have if it gives the Palestinians its own state is that you've had four generations of Arab Israelis who are 20% of the population of Israel. Are you going to kick them out? Mm-hmm. You have all sorts of difficult issues creating a second two-state solution. And we've never even answered the knotty problem of the settlers. If you have settlers and you decide to create a two-state solution, are you going to create Bantustans or are you going to allow those settlers to be absorbed into a Palestinian state? In effect, creating 700,000 Israelis or Jewish Jewish Palestinians who are Palestinians.
Mm.
So those problems are really, really, really difficult to resolve, which leads me to conclude that this two-state solution is a very difficult one practically to do. Now, politically and ideologically, it is even harder to do because the two societies are further apart and more extreme and more polarized in their positions. Basically, they hate each other more than they've ever done. Right?
Mm.
So how do you get an agreement to get to that point? So the other option is to have a one-state solution where you have two binational state, where everybody has the same rights and Jews have a homeland and all of those things, right? Which looks like it's more viable, but it's actually more difficult to do. So that's the answer to
the first
question.
Mm-hmm.
First question. There's a lot more to say about that, but I'll stop there for the moment.
Okay.
The second question about what is the strategic impact of new powers, if new powers enter the fray. Well, welcome to the current world that we're in, because that is what is happening right now.
Mm.
Right? The Abraham Accords, one of the main strategic considerations of the Abraham Accords, what that underpins the entire accord is security. Right? Bringing the Saudis and the Israelis under the American security umbrella to isolate Iran. Unfortunately for them, Iran has now allied itself with China and Russia. And the Saudis have read the tea leaves and they've decided, you know, we're going to make peace with Iran.
Mm.
Now, one of the most interesting things that happened when Iran retaliated against the Israeli bombing of its consulate.
Mm.
Was that they told the Saudis and the Emiratis, we are going to retaliate. And if you dare join with the Americans, we will consider you hostile. And the Saudis and the Emiratis did not give overflight rights to the Americans and the Israelis. If you notice, they said the Saudis provided some help and some intelligence. Intelligence.
That's right, yes.
Right? So what that means is that everybody recognizes that the Iranians can do a tremendous amount of harm to everybody, which was the reason why, one of the main reasons why you have the Abraham Accords, which is to stop the growth of Iran as a regional power.
Okay.
Now, the Russians, right, are mm-hmm. supporting the Iranians because they've both been working against the Saudis and the Emiratis in Egypt. in Syria. But the new configuration in the Middle East is that you cannot do anything without the Iranians. Now, that the rise of Iran has been a consequence of the misadventures of the Americans and the Saudis and the Israelis in the Middle East.
Okay.
Right? And I'll give it to you in order of misadventure. When Israel invaded Lebanon in the late 1980s, right, it gave rise to a group called Hezbollah, right, who were a resistance movement to the Israeli invasion in Lebanon. Hezbollah is the only Arab army to have ever inflicted a defeat on the Israeli Defense Force. They pulled out of Lebanon because Hezbollah harassed them out, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Hezbollah has developed battle-ready capacity that can hurt Israel. At this point in time, northern Israel, right, has been depopulated. In other words, the people, Israeli people living in the northern Israel near the border with Lebanon are not there anymore. They're all in Tel Aviv and in Jerusalem, because they've had to be evacuated. They are internally displaced persons inside Israel.
Yeah, I'm going to hurry you up. The lines are going crazy. So many questions for you.
So it is already happening. It's not that it is. It's already happening.
Mm-hmm.
And Hezbollah is just one example.
So that's the first misadventure. What's the second misadventure?
Second misadventure was the Yemeni war, which gave rise to the Houthis. Now, this is a combination of both the Emiratis and the Saudis, and they're the kind of what you're seeing in Gaza occurred in Yemen with the Saudis and the Emiratis. The interesting thing about the Houthis is that they are what are called Zaidi Shias, and these Shias are actually not Shia at all; they're Sunnis with a slight twist.
Right.
But the Saudis went after them hammer and tongs, and the Emiratis funded mercenaries. You're going to love this, Hegarty. Funded mercenaries to go fight them. And those mercenaries committed all sorts of human rights abuses and atrocities. And who were those mercenaries? Those mercenaries are the same people who are the rapid support force in Sudan.
Wow.
Right? Who are responsible for all the atrocities in where? Darfur.
Yeah.
So you can see all of this stuff.
It's all interwoven, honestly. And this is why I wanted you on this show, because people don't realize how all these global issues are so conjoined everywhere. They're like hydra-headed in a way that you would never imagine it. But I've got to, there's a line that's been going. Let me interrupt you. Let me answer this. I'll come back to you. Okay. Hello?
No problem.
Oops, I came to you. You can call back 0700-993-993-993-0201-465-7190. Okay, I'm coming to you now. Hello?
Yes, okay.
Yes, Kalabunko, very quickly.
Thank you. I agree to guess. I want to ask a guess. Is it Shebi? Maybe. Hamas are fighting for the control of West Bank, Jerusalem and the Golan Heights. That's number one. See, Senator, I want to ask you, if you say Hamas are resistant army, when they won election in Gaza, why did they pursue Palestinian Authority?
Okay, thank you.
If they are resistant army, if they are terrorists.
Okay.
Why did they pursue Palestinian army?
Okay. The Palestinian Authority, not Palestinian army. There's never been a Palestinian army. All right, I get you. I get you. I had to correct him. Koboko, there's never been a Palestinian army. You mean the Palestinian Authority. Koboko asked a very good question. He said, look, if Hamas is a resistance group and they won the election in what, 2006, thank you. In 2006, why then did they kick out the Palestinian Authority?
Okay, I think I answered that question earlier. But
I believe you did, but just give us a short version.
I'll elaborate on that. Hamas won the election in Gaza. They also won the election in the West Bank. And the reason why they won the election wasn't because anybody loved Hamas, but because they hated the Palestinian Authority, because they were corrupt and incompetent, right? And so the people voted them out, right? But because people, the Israelis were adamantly against talking to Hamas. The British didn't like Hamas, and the Americans thought Hamas were a terrorist organization. The Egyptians have a visceral dislike of Hamas, probably more so than the Israelis, because Hamas came out of the Islamic Brotherhood, right?
Mm-hmm.
They came out of the Islamic Brotherhood, which is an Egyptian organization. So your question is absolutely correct, that it's not an it's an indigenous Palestinian movement that sprung from an Egyptian movement, right? And so why did they fight with the Palestinian Authority? Well, the Palestinian Authority didn't want to lose power, and the Israelis and the Egyptians and the British and the Americans decided to support them to try and take power back. The Hamas now showed that they were actually far better at violence than the Palestinian Authority in Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
And so they kicked the Palestinian Authority out. So it wasn't as if Hamas were looking for a fight. They were looking to take control of government, and the Palestinian Authority didn't like it.
Okay.
It's not as if the Palestinian people preferred Hamas. They just didn't like the Palestinian Authority.
Okay. One of the names, I believe so, one of the names that we hear a lot about is Yahya Sinwar. To us, okay, hold that question, write that down, because the lines are going again. I'm going to come to one call, and then I'll come back to you. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, good afternoon, good evening.
Good evening.
What, you need to turn your radio off, otherwise, hello?
This is Pastor Badamosi, am I okay now?
Yeah, Pastor Badamosi, good evening. Go ahead, your question, please.
Yeah. I want to ask the guys there, why... The Jews or the Israeli government has allowed the Zionism to fester so much,
okay,
and to disrupt so much, because the problem is interwoven. It's complex, but this Zionist movement, Jewish Zionism, how can we quell it? How can we stop it?
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Right. It's a good question, actually, which is, how has the Israeli society allowed Zionism to literally arrest and you know, hold on to, seize a society that's based on, well, apparently based on Judaism, whereas Zionism is based on the exclusion of others. Judaism is about love and so much more. How has that happened? And then to the first question, I'll let you go. I do still want to, you have to hurry up, because I want to talk about Ukraine war. Quickly, I know you're smiling. I want to try and sneak that in since I've got you.
I'm going to answer the two questions on Yahya Sinwar. Yahya Sinwar was a Palestinian enforcer. And he basically was the counterinsurgency head of Palestinian enforcement of Hamas, very close to the founder of Hamas, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. And Sinwar's job was to ferret out the informers and basically eliminate them. And the reason why he was in an Israeli jail was because he murdered Palestinian informants.
How long was he in Israeli jail for?
I think he was in jail for a number of years.
Okay. Okay, so he went to jail. Because what?
He was convicted of murder,
okay,
right? But he wasn't convicted of the murder of Israelis. He was convicted of the murder of Palestinians who were informants for the Israelis.
Is that the Palestinian that was thrown down from the roof?
No. The person that was thrown down was actually a Shin Bet officer. I believe it's an Israeli spy that was in Gaza. And they basically threw him off the building.
Right.
Because they found out. They probably found his informants, and his informants, they tortured them, and the informants probably fingered him. I'm just speculating here. I don't know anything. They fingered him, and they cracked him, they got him, and they basically threw him out of window during the Second Intifada. But that's, Yahya Sinwar has a reputation for being incredibly ruthless, and he doesn't spare a thought for eliminating anybody who is a snitch.
Hmm.
And you know, some people in the intelligence world have reckoned that one of the reasons why Hamas has been so effective, diabolically effective, actually, if you really want to put it that way, has been because they've ensured that Israel doesn't have any human intelligence or adequate human intelligence in Gaza.
I see. Let me just come back to that. Oh, I see. So one of the reasons why Israel's prosecution of this so-called war, they said, they initially said was against Hamas, is because they didn't have any intelligence. The almighty Israel didn't have any intelligence within Gaza itself.
Well, human intelligence, I think, is a key word here.
Right.
They have a lot of intelligence. They surveil the Palestinians. But human intelligence is something, I mean, somebody that's infiltrated deep into the Gaza, to the Hamas hierarchy, I think that was something difficult for them. And I think they may not have even thought they needed it with all the high-tech eavesdropping that they had. But it does appear that, you know, October 7th, if they had serious human intelligence, they would have known more about it.
Or at least taking the warning seriously. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, but sorry.
The second one. This is what I'm hearing from people who are in the intelligence, have been interviewed on CNN and other places, who have said to that effect that these guys have basically wound up whatever informant network that they had. They've been, and their leader is somebody who spent 30, 40 years doing that.
Mm.
Going back to the issue of how Israeli society has allowed Zionism to be the dominant narrative in Israeli society, it's a good question. To a large extent, the hierarchy of society in Israel and the Ashkenazi Jews, who are the European Jews who come from Europe. And they are the ones with the most visceral experience of the Holocaust. And Zionism basically created, was elevated after the Holocaust, because, you know, the Jews never wanted to experience anything like that again. And nobody should experience anything like that again. And so Zionism, which hitherto was kind of fringe, became something that was very, you know, very much a leading a trope for them. The Arab Jews didn't have the same love for Zionism as the Ashkenazim Jews, but, you know, Ashkenazim Jews came with all the strength of Europe, economic, military, and all of that stuff, and the knowledge that they brought in from Europe, the technological advantage that they brought in for Europe. And to some extent, that has prevailed in allowing them to have a qualitative military edge over their neighbors. I mean, it's amazing, you know, that these 7 million people are able to wage war against 200 million Arabs. It's staggering, and it's something you may not like them, but it's something you have to marvel at.
Mm.
And so that is the effect of Zionism on the state of Israel. The other thing that I kind of find really, really amazing, it's something that is a testament to Judaism's historical narrative and their culture, the 5,000 or 3,000 year old culture, in that when they founded the state of Israel, I think there were less than 3,000 or 5,000 people who actually spoke Hebrew in the world.
Right.
And now they all speak Hebrew. You know?
I have a question.
Yiddish was a language.
Was a bigger language, yes, indeed.
In Europe.
Yes.
But Hebrew was not a language that they spoke. And I believe it was the Arab Jews who were able to preserve Hebrew as a language.
So interesting. It's such an interest. The whole area, everything that happens there is so interesting. I have a question for you, and then I'm going to give you 2 minutes, and then I want you to talk to us about Ukraine, Russia-Ukraine war, and what impact this is going to have, in addition to this, on Biden's chances in November elections in America. So here's a question I have for you. Good evening, madam. I disagree with Najim that Israel treated the Palestinians better than the Arab Gulf just because they are Israeli Arab citizens. I think the Arab Gulf strategy is to keep the Palestinians' statehood alive, hence needless to give them citizenship status in countries like Jordan and Saudi Arabia, etc. That's from Tajuddin. What do you think?
Tajuddin.
So what Tajuddin is saying is, look,
Tajuddin is correct. You're in a catch-22 situation.
Right.
If you give them citizenship, the Israelis will send more refugees your way.
Right.
if you don't give them citizenship, right, you get beaten in the head by people like me saying, you're Arabs, they're your Arab brothers. I'm a Muslim, right?
Mm.
My job is to take my brother refugee in as my own, right? The Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, migrated from Makkah to Medina, right? Set up home in Medina. There were families that shared their houses with Medina. They became people from Medina.
Mm.
When the Prophet went back to Makkah, right, the people of Medina were weeping, thinking he would never come back to Medina with them after the conquest of Makkah. And he said, no, that he was going back home with them because Medina had become home. Now, I am speaking about this as a Muslim.
Mm.
It is the right of the Muslim to be housed by his fellow Muslim in another country.
Right.
Right? That you don't do that is, for me, it's egregious. Now, if you want to make a peace with the Israelis, which is a very laudable and plausible thing under the Abraham Accords, right? For me, the most easiest way to persuade the Israelis to accept a one-state solution where there are two nations in that state, the Palestinians and the Israelis, on an equal footing, right, is to remove the problem that the Israelis fear the most, which is the right of Palestinians to return, right? You can do that by having the other nation say, okay, we will give all the Palestinians who are here citizenship. So the right of return doesn't immediately swamp the Israelis with 20 million Palestinians in the neighboring countries.
But then there's also the option of Palestinians not wanting it, because there will be Palestinians who will say, no, I want to go back to my land.
But the point I'm trying to get at is that a negotiation is a settlement. Nobody gets everything.
Very much
right?
so.
It's not perfect,
right?
But it's workable. We've seen Bosnia and Herzegovina, we've seen that work.
Mm.
Right? We've seen that work. It wasn't an easy thing to make, but we've seen it work.
Yeah.
We've seen other countries where this is working.
Mm.
And we've seen countries where it isn't, like India, North Korea. It isn't working.
Mm.
So just to give you an example of what I'm trying to come across here, I'm trying to be pragmatic.
Of course.
As well as sticking to the tenets of my faith.
Yeah. Now, Ukraine-Russia war, we've got, 8 minutes. So, America just gave more money to Ukraine. America just gave more money to Israel, or arms, whatever you want to call it. Biden is not doing well in opinion polls. Young people who would normally vote Democrat are the ones rebelling, protesting, and saying, not in my name. They are the ones who are now demanding that America, if you like, the universities divest from Israeli business, etc. Even more so is America is seeing, and this is my opinion, almost equivalent, and if they're not careful, the equivalent of the anti-Vietnam War liberation movement, etc. What are your thoughts on that? What is the impact of Ukraine-Russia war on this whole Israel-Gaza war, and what is Biden's chances, and how should he be dealing with it that he's not? I can only give you 5 minutes. We don't even have time. 5 minutes. You got to talk fast.
I'm going to talk fast. On Ukraine, right, it looks pretty bad for the Ukrainians. I don't think they're going to recover the land that they've lost, and that's just me. I'm not an expert on it, but I find it difficult for them to recover the land that they've lost. I find it very interesting that the timing of this, the unblocking of this 60 million, don't forget it's been there for 6 months or 7 months, and the Republicans have refused to allow the bill to go. I find that the unblocking of this aid coincides with the Iranians firing rockets at Israel. It's literally...
Is that a cynical... I mean, that's literally as cynical as it comes, right?
Well, it was one of the things that forced the Republicans, because they did want to, you know, they didn't want to leave Israel in the lurch, and Biden could use it as a cudgel against them in the campaign. So they quickly released the money so that Biden could send the money to Ukrainians. The real money that they wanted to send was to Israel. And the Republicans had told Biden, well, we can give Israel the money, but we don't see why we have to give it to Ukraine.
Hmm.
So, of course, when Israel came under attack by the Iranians,
They had to release both.
They had to release both for everything. And then they released money for Taiwan. Now, this is the interesting thing. You've got 61, or was it $93 billion? I don't know how much it is, right? Released to $93 billion released to Ukraine, Taiwan, and Israel. What's the common combination between all of those three, right? Russia in Ukraine, the Chinese.
That's right.
Right? And the Iranians.
Near Israel. Yeah.
So the Americans have got their hands full. And at this point in time, they don't know how to manage, they do know how to manage, but they don't, I don't know whether there's a proper strategy here to engage, to get the Ukrainians to engage with the Russians. I think the Russians, everybody agrees to some extent that the Russians have the military upper hand. And the question for the Ukrainians is whether they can actually fight to a point where it makes sense for the Russians to make peace with the Ukrainians. So the question is, what are the strategic objectives of the Russians and what are the desires, the practically achievable desires of the Ukrainians?
Okay, let me be unfair to you then. Will Trump end both wars very quickly?
I think this is where Trump has an advantage. And I've been thinking about it for the last couple of weeks. Trump seems to me to be a politician, as John Bolton says, that has no first principles. So he's not afraid of selling anybody down the line. Right? Now, he likes Putin and he wants to resolve the issue in Ukraine. But Putin also owes the Iranians a huge debt, which now means that the Israelis are going to have to make a negotiation because they're not going to have the unfettered access to Trump that they had before. And even if Jared Kushner's son-in-law, even if Jared Kushner has a very big position in Trump's administration, there is an apparent some funds, about $2 billion that he has made from his dealings with the Saudis, which now creates all sorts of conflicts of interest would impact any decision making. So I think Trump may actually prove to be a better bet for the Russians and for the Palestinians than they think.
Wow.
I know it sounds crazy.
It does. Who would have thought so? Because, look, the last time I heard Trump talk about the Palestinian, Israel-Palestine war was, he said, look, I'm going to tell Netzi, get on with it quickly. Finish it quickly. And I'm thinking, what does this man mean? Finish it quickly. And he leaves it all open in the air.
The thing is very clear. The statement was actually quite interesting because what he said was, you need to get this over and done with.
In other words,
we can't continue to support you. It looks bad. And he said, it looks bad. So Trump doesn't like to look bad. And the other thing Trump hates more than looking bad is he hates supporting a loser.
Wow.
And you remember the article that you mentioned earlier by
Chaim
Levin?
Yes.
Which says that Israel has lost. So when you put all of that together, Trump is more likely to cut his losses, as he did with the Taliban.
It's funny you should say that. Somebody sent in a message regarding that and said something to the effect of, Sisioge, stop being delusional, right? To that. Sisioge, stop being delusional. Israel has not lost in any way, shape, or form. You are telling yourselves what you want to hear to make yourself feel good. I don't know why they think I should be feeling good about it, but perhaps you might want to respond to that. You've got a minute.
As I said, there are no winners here. Everybody has lost to some extent, right? The Palestinians have lost enormously because Gaza is unlivable, right? 30,000, 40,000, 100,000 people lost. You don't get back from that easily. What they do have is this concept of sumud, which is steadfastness, that we will not be moved, right? And so that will be passed on from generation to generation, but that doesn't...